Welcome to the Court of Appeals, June 26th. We have three matters on the oral calendar this morning and three on the non-oral calendar. The first matter, State of Minnesota versus Risha Moy Harvey. Is Risha correct? Did I pronounce that correctly?
It's Risha.
Risha? Okay, thank you. A19-0049. A reminder that both counsel will have opportunity up to 15 minutes and then appellant 5 minutes in response, a rebuttal if you wish. You'll note the lights on the podium, so when you get to yellow, try to wrap up any comments that you might have. And if the parties are ready to proceed, also make sure to identify yourself for the record when you do approach the podium. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Abigail Rankin, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Ms. Risha Moy Harvey. There are two issues before you today in this matter. First, whether the restitution statute permits the restitution ordered in this case. And second, if so, whether the district court erroneously conflated direct and contributory causes in her findings. The restitution statutes allow for out-of-pocket losses resulting from the crime. They require the court to consider the amount of economic loss sustained as a result of the offense. The Supreme Court in Riggs considered these statutes and looked at what the offense and the crime might mean in these contexts. That court specifically found that you just consider the loss sustained by the victim as a result of the consequence, or as a consequence of the defendant's violation of the law. Similarly, this court has repeatedly held in Nelson, Olson, and Latimer, for example, that you consider the losses that result from the offense of conviction, the conduct for which the defendant was convicted.
Now, there's no doubt that there was an offense by your client in addition to leaving the scene. There wasn't a conviction, but it wasn't disputed, was it, that she turned in front of another vehicle, failing to yield a right-of-way?
Correct. The turn was not disputed. The cause of the subsequent accident was.
Well, but regardless of the cause of the accident, there's no dispute that she committed an offense.
Correct.
In driving in front of the other car. Why is the district court out of bounds from considering that offense if it is undisputed? Now, I understand if there had been a charge and the charge was dismissed because there wasn't a basis for it or because there was a reasonable conflict about the facts, but in this case, there doesn't seem to be.
I would argue there is a conflict about the facts here, and that's demonstrated by the plea agreement that was reached. Prior to the plea negotiations, the parties participated in a contested omnibus hearing at which the defense requested the use of an expert. The defense's expert testified about causality and testified specifically that without DC's speed, Ms. Harvey would have been able to clear the intersection, and that DC's speed was therefore the primary cause of the accident.
Right, she was still a cause of the accident. Had she not turned in front of the motorcyclist, there wouldn't have been a collision with the motorcycle.
That's correct.
And that was an offense.
Yes, a traffic offense.
Failure to yield, one way or the other.
Certainly.
So I'm curious, why wouldn't, in that circumstance, the district court be permitted to consider that offense, even though it's not the offense of conviction and that she wasn't charged, she didn't plead guilty to that offense? What's the strongest case for the proposition that the court can't consider that undisputed offense?
One of the strongest cases, I believe, would be Riggs, which indicates that you can't consider the circumstances surrounding the offense when determining the quantity of restitution. So that case looked at the victim's involvement and fault in terms of trying to mitigate some of the fault and the restitution as a result and reducing the amount of restitution. The cases of this court as well, Nelson, Olson, and Latimer, all required consideration of the conduct for which the defendant was convicted. Nelson specifically involved a series of thefts from a tanning salon at which the defendant was employed. She was charged for a number of felonies and then a misdemeanor as a result of those thefts. And as part of the plea, the felonies preceding the misdemeanor were dismissed, and she pleaded only to that misdemeanor. Restitution was subsequently ordered for a larger chunk than just that misdemeanor responsibility, and this court found that the compensable loss must be directly caused by the conduct for which she was convicted, which is the misdemeanor, and any preceding conduct restitution for any preceding conduct was inappropriate.
Well, can I ask you about the charge of conviction?
Yes.
I don't think the parties argued about this, but it's a curious thing in the statute. Subdivision 14, 169.09, identifies the penalties for violating subdivision 1 or subdivision 6, mm-hmm. and she was convicted or pleaded guilty for 1 and 3, right?
I believe so.
So it says the driver of any vehicle who violates subdivision 1 or 6 and who did not cause the collision is punishable as follows. And so there's a description of the penalties if the driver didn't cause the collision. And I'm not sure, I didn't find a place in the statute that has a different penalty when the driver does cause the collision. But it seems that in this case, the cause of the collision, because of the penalty language, does seem to be incorporated into the crime of conviction. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I disagree. The statute under which she was charged and the facts offered in the plea support involvement in and not a cause. The statute requires just involvement in the accident and then leaving with the great bodily harm element as well. And when Ms. Harvey entered her plea, the colloquy contemplated simply involvement in a collision. There are no other facts in the plea colloquy that would support a finding of causality here.
Well, except that didn't she acknowledge in the plea and in the record, undisputedly, that she pulled in front of the motorcycle she hit the rear of the motorcycle. So she turned into the motorcycle. That's not disputed, and that was part of the plea, wasn't it?
If I remember correctly, I believe the plea contemplated, or the plea colloquy itself just referred to being involved in the accident, mm-hmm. And described the injuries or the great bodily harm that resulted from the accident. I don't know if it was that specific about how it came about.
The district court did enter findings in the record as to how it came about.
She did, yes.
And those aren't disputed.
That's correct.
Ms. Rankin, kind of following up on Judge Ross's question, it looks like, if I understand correctly, the criminal vehicular operation element that was charged mm-hmm. includes the specific, looks like subdivision 1-7, where the driver causes the accident, leaves the scene. Is it your understanding that that is the companion, essentially, to the felony leaving the scene for which he did plead? In other words, it's my understanding the original complaint was the CVO only and a DUI, if I recall. And so is that the answer to that? I too, was wondering about that penalty provision leaving the scene. Is that essentially because in all cases where the exact scenario where one causes it, they're charged under the CVO statute and not the leaving the scene?
Yes, I think that would be true. The CVO statute, as you noted, is almost identical to the leaving the scene with great bodily harm with the addition of that causality requirement.
Do you know why, given then the plea agreement in which the CVO is dismissed, your client pleads guilty to the leaving the scene, not causing, mm-hmm. that counsel, when it came to the restitution hearing, stipulated to reports? If causation was in dispute, why did not your client present evidence, including the expert report, to allow cross-examination to get to the heart of the causation as it relates to restitution, not no longer as it relates to the crime?
She did offer, or my client's counsel did offer, the expert's reports and an updated expert report, as well as some simulations produced by the expert for that omnibus hearing, at which the expert was cross-examined on the issue of causality. That was going to be the purpose of the expert's testimony, so they covered a lot of that in that contested omnibus. I'm not sure what counsel's reasoning was as to why not to dispute that in a full hearing, but I would note that the police reports don't indicate legal causality. They don't. There's no actual witness testimony that they are trained in this kind of accident construction or they understand that sort of thing and that she is legally responsible for the accident.
So the expert did testify at the Frymac hearing And you used the phrase, the expert opined, the primary cause was actually the victim. So that's in the record?
It is.
And the court was aware of that, that the primary cause of the collision was the speed of the motorcycle driver victim.
Yes, the court was aware of that, and the court considered that in its conclusions. I believe in paragraph 3 of its conclusions, the court said that the defendant is not exonerated from being a contributory cause of the accident based on the expert's testimony, because, or even assuming that that DC's speed was the primary cause.
Were there any other experts? Did the state and others have a reconstruction or anyone else that...
The state didn't offer any expert testimony, no.
So that would suggest if we were in the tort world, if victim was plaintiff, would have been without recourse because it would have been greater than 50%, apparently, assuming a fact finder found the expert credible.
I'm not very familiar with the tort world, so I don't want to speculate, but I have no doubt that's the case.
Case law is pretty clear on the question of the difference between tort and restitution, though, isn't it? And
it is.
That it doesn't matter if the victim played some part in contributing. The question is, what was the result of the offense?
That's correct.
And the result of the offense in this case was the collision. Assume your argument is correct on the idea that we have to consider only the leaving the scene. Mm-hmm. And one of the obligations that a driver has when there's a personal injury accident is to render reasonable assistance under subdivision 3 of 169.09. And there's a separate provision for contacting law enforcement to make sure that the assistance is given. But there's a rendering assistance requirement. If you're correct on your legal theory that the district court can only consider any harm resulting from leaving the scene as opposed to the collision, why would we reverse? Why wouldn't we remand for the district court to enter a finding regarding the extent to which there may be some loss resulting from the failure to stop, as distinguished from losses from the collision itself?
Certainly. The district court's order is quite clear that the losses resulted from the traffic accident. There is no testimony or information in the record that would suggest that Ms. Harvey's leaving the scene delayed the assistance to DC. And in fact, the footage from the security cameras in the neighborhood showed that he was immediately tended by others around him, and the police were immediately called.
Ms. Rankin, could I ask you, getting back to the Riggs case, it was Justice Gilday's, I believe it's her footnote, perhaps it's not, perhaps it's the majority of footnote 5. Unlike the dissent of Justice Page, we do not interpret the language, and this is referring to the statutory language, to mean the offense of conviction. What does that footnote mean to you as it applies to this case and your client?
First, I would assert that the footnote is dicta and not binding. And second, I would point this court to its own reasoning in preceding cases, Nelson, Olson, and Latimer, that do specifically contemplate the conduct of the conviction being the universe of facts considered for restitution. So I don't believe that particular footnote has, it doesn't say that, I don't want to use double negatives, but the footnote doesn't say that we don't, that they're not making a holding on that. They're saying that they don't consider it for the purpose of that opinion. They're making an assertion, or the majority is making an assertion that that's for the purpose of their reasoning, but I don't believe that they're making a holding there that the footnote is law.
And I may have been unfair to you. If you recall, the first part of that footnote is the parties do not dispute that the victim's economic loss occurred as a result of the offense.
Precisely.
So I suppose when you read the two together, is that the point you're making, is that was not an issue that court was resolving in any
exactly.
event, the issue that we have here today?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
A cause must come before an effect. Here, the offense followed the harm. That that offense could not therefore be the cause of the effect of the harm that that DC sustained here.
Assuming we can go beyond the offense of conviction and look at other offenses, mm-hmm. is there any other case that you've come upon like this one where the facts that are admitted by everyone as the certain facts of the case establish beyond any question? I mean, it absolutely necessarily establish an offense.
Many of the other cases that consider this issue do involve offenses that follow. So, for example, I believe it was Boettcher, which is currently under review at the Supreme Court, that had a burglary and then an arson. The arson was dismissed. The restitution was ordered for the house damages from the fire. So a lot of those do have distinct there are two separate offenses.
Right, but in that case, there was a dispute as to mm-hmm. whether, in fact, a finding that, as to about a conflict of facts and whether there was a preceding offense. Mm-hmm. Have you found any case like this one where the facts establish beyond any question, as a matter of law, that there was an offense? When a driver fails to yield at an intersection, regardless of the oncoming driver's speed or who causes the accident, that's an offense. So were you able to come across any cases like this one where the facts established unequivocally that an offense certainly happened as a matter of law?
I'm not certain that I was. There are some cases that suggest that, like Nelson with the various felony thefts that predated and were dismissed simply as a matter of a time bar. But I haven't seen anything quite as specific as this one, where the offenses are that close together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is Sean Cahill. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota in this case. I ask that the court affirm the district court's restitution order from October 11th of 2018. With regard, I'll first start. State's opinion is that the district court did a thorough review of a rather thorough record here and actually had quite a substantial bit of evidence which to make his determination about how this accident occurred, had surveillance video. I believe there's restitution exhibits 6 and 7 particularly, which showed in great detail the actual accident itself, showing, first of all, not only the collision, but the act of the appellant pulling into the lane, as noted by Justice Ross, that really is part of this offense and conduct that really is part of an entire, what I'd say is one singular course of conduct.
It was part of an offensive conduct, but she wasn't charged with it.
Correct.
Assume that, for the sake of argument, that we will apply only the... Let me strike that and ask a different question. Let's change the facts a little bit. I'm curious how you would approach it if these were the circumstances. Assume that the victim was not on a motorcycle but was a pedestrian mm-hmm. who had just immediately told friends that he intended to commit suicide by leaping in front of a moving car and that he in fact did so in front of bystanders who immediately called for an ambulance and police. And the facts are otherwise the same. There was substantial bodily harm. Ms. Harvey, the driver, leaves the scene. Under those circumstances, what's the appropriate measure of restitution in that case?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways we can approach that. First of all, I'd note under the restitution statutes, we do not look to the conduct of the victim. First, under the statute, the only two criteria are the economic loss sustained by the victim and the resources and the essentially income of the defendant. But this also falls on the discretion of the court in making, is this person's conduct a cause of the injury here? And if there is essentially a showing that this person intentionally maybe threw themselves out into traffic, that would cut against, let's say, a factual finding that the appellant's driving conduct was reckless or somehow was dangerous or somehow she was unable to avoid the collision. But that's not what we have here. This one,
you've also charged no insurance, so assume the same hypothetical, and no insurance is also, and that's the offense. Mm-hmm. Is that still not the incident, if I understand your argument, that led to this individual's injuries?
Yes, that the lack of having insurance, I think, in a number of ways, is a possible resolution. It was charged, and her driving conduct in and of itself was illegal. And as a part of that is you could argue that the fact that she got an accident before she was even supposed to be driving, or she was driving without the requisite insurance, does flow from that conduct.
But in the offense here, though, just to clarify, there is no conclusion that the driving conduct was illegal. It was the failing to stop when involved in an accident. Aren't there many situations where at an uncontrolled intersection there's an accident, no one's charged with any particular offense except maybe no insurance or no driver's license, but in terms of the driving conduct, essentially one person leaves, that person will be charged with failing to leave the scene. And there's no conclusion at that stage or by that offense that that person caused that accident, because the obligation is to report.
Certainly, I'd say that is going a little bit back to your discussion on the offense of conviction and the offense generally of the incident. As you noted, yes, this case was a plea to the failure to stop. However, was also charged was the CVO, the criminal vehicular operation, which is reckless driving, which resulted in great bodily harm.
Did the defendant or appellant admit to any of the elements of, besides failing to report, which was the same in the two that otherwise would be in the CVO?
Yeah, the conduct of the plea admitted within the plea are, first of all, that she knew that a stop occurred. And I think this is important when the court looks at the elements of the offense of failure to stop. It does look back factually to the fact that, first, an accident occurred, and two, that a person involved in an accident has a duty to reasonably investigate to see if there is injury. So I'd say just on the nature of the criminal conduct is there imposes that duty to go and investigate whether that injury occurs. It presumes that that is part of what's going on here. And that is, in fact, admitted to within the plea hearing. I believe it is at transcripts pages 6 and 7, if I'm correct. Really what it is, if you take a look, she admits, first of all, is, yes, I admit that there was an accident, that I struck the motorcycle person. And the language that they use, and this is after the incident occurred, or at least the collision, she failed to stop without rendering aid, contact the police, or providing insurance required by the statute, or by traffic laws, as they noted. So she admitted that she knew that there was an accident, she knew that there was a potential for injury, and that she failed to render aid.
So even getting back to Judge Ross's hypothetical, is restitution appropriate for the person that intended to kill oneself and has the same injuries that we have here?
Your Honor, I think if there is a factual basis that the driver's conduct essentially in some way did contribute to that in a way that they should not have been driving, that they was somehow dangerous, and part of their offense of failing to stop or failing to render aid, absolutely.
So where in the restitution statute do you derive that language? And in particular, I'm inquiring, as you might expect, under 045 subdivision 1, parens 1, the amount of economic loss sustained by the victim as a result of the offense.
Correct.
What is the offense mean to you?
You know, I believe in this, the similar that we look at possibly for sake of analogy in sentencing, a course of conduct. A course of the fact that there is a conviction, also the elements of the crime and the conduct admitted.
Go ahead.
The legislature is aware that there's fuzzier language to be used, mm-hmm. and it uses that language in other contexts. Course of conduct, behavioral conduct, but the offense with a definite article indicates that there is a specific offense that is to be considered in restitution. Are you suggesting that's not so?
No, Your Honor, I would suggest that really if we're going to look for how do we draw a scope on offense, specifically we can look to the conduct admitted, the elements of the crime, and what is the conduct underlying those elements. And
so when you say the crime, we were talking about the offense, and that's the offense of conviction. I just want to narrow down what you're actually arguing, that we're talking about the offense of conviction. Let me try it a different way. Are you saying that you agree that we're focused on the offense of conviction, but your position is that that offense may have arisen from a set of circumstances that can be considered even if they didn't contribute to an element of the offense? Is that your argument?
Yes, in the sense where the offense of conviction here is looks back to include these facts that there had to have been this accident that essentially starts out this whole issue. It is, and this is where I was talking about with the inextricably intertwined. you can't flee the accident without having this accident that occurred and looking at your conduct within that.
So let me spin the hypothetical a little differently, and I think maybe Judge Leader's question got to this. Assume my hypothetical or the facts of this is the facts of the, include the facts of this case, or the facts of this case, which is that drivers operating without a say with a revoked license or without insurance, but operating otherwise lawfully, following the traffic laws, and a pedestrian steps out in front intentionally, and the driver leaves the scene. Restitution or no restitution?
Restitution.
Because?
I put to you, it's similar to a forfeiture by wrongdoing, and here's why. The service of restitution serves both a punitive and rehabilitative purpose. The traditional means that we offer compensation.
When I said because, I mean because of what language in the statute?
Thank you. Yeah, at this point, I would say that the if we're looking at whether or not it is a result of the offense, the economic loss is a result of the offense, we can say that, yes, this person was injured. They had to pay out for, let's say, medical care for their injuries. That's an economic loss. However, they are also entitled, and the reason why we have the insurance statutes, is to recover from that economic loss by traditional means of compensation. This creates, I think, a separate injury, aside from the actual physical injury, but the deprivation of access to compensation for your economic loss, particularly through the, either the insurance system or the traditional civil lawsuit.
We don't have a case on point on that hypothetical, do we? I mean, is there a case that, that essentially tracks the hypothetical that I've just described where the driver is otherwise violating or violating no traffic laws except for either driving with a revoked license or without insurance?
I did not find any, Your Honor, but I think this is also our notion of why is this a unique injury. I'd note this is, at least for a point, a very factually unique injury to this type of case. You know, you're not going to find this necessarily in many other statutes because we've imposed the duty on society to stop and provide insurance. Why? Because this alleviates, one, you have a right to consider who is at fault, you have a right to determine contributory causes, you have a right to have that considered by your insurance company. That's how we operate. That's how we get compensated for our medical losses. By taking a driver's ability to operate within that system, you are forcing them to essentially pay out of their own pocket that economic loss of whatever their medical expenses might be, whatever injuries might have happened, and you're essentially being deprived of your right to be compensated through these traditional means.
If we agree with Ms. Rankin's argument that the offense that we're talking about is the offense of conviction, and we don't go back further to other possible offending conduct, do you agree with her that there would be no reason to remand to consider the factual question of whether there was some harm that resulted from leaving the scene as opposed to harm that results from the conviction because no evidence was introduced distinguishing those two or suggesting that there was some harm that resulted from leaving the scene by itself?
I would disagree. I think there is evidence in the fact that first of all, we have established what the injury was, the amount of the medical costs to the victim, and the fact that he had his foot amputated. So we have a sense of what the injury was. We also have in the facts that she did not stop provide insurance. She did not provide identifying information. The court already has the amount and everything that is required.
My question, are there facts that would distinguish between the harm that resulted from the collision itself mm-hmm. and as distinguished from leaving the scene, and which was her greater harm? Had she stayed on the scene, would she have sustained less injury? Are there facts that would support that argument by the state?
I would offer that if she had stopped, provided insurance, it would have the amount of the physical injury, he would have not had an economic loss because it possibly could have been covered by insurance or he could have received compensation through a civil lawsuit. And essentially, saying is he would I know the identify of the driver. If there was insurance, that insurance could be addressed through there. So essentially, is yes, there is a separate, distinct injury by her not getting out of the car and giving insurance because that economic loss, while we have a number associated with the actual physical injury, he is now not able to have that paid out by the traditional means of compensation. He can't get paid.
Mr. Cahill, is it true? if I understand the facts correctly, that the original two charges were the CVO charge itself and a DUI. Then there's the expert defense hires that opines the primary cause was the victim's speed. And it's after that in which leaving the scene is amended to include, which is the offense that ultimately defendant pleads guilty to. And we've got a correlation we don't often have that's the element that's specifically in conflict with each other is the CVO requires specifically a jury find that the defendant caused the accident, and the offense for which she pled guilty to is that she specifically did not cause. Would it be safe to presume from those very also unique specific facts that the state felt after that expert report it could not prove that she caused the accident, whereas didn't need to show that in this other offense? And that's what led to the plea agreement, which of course then leads then to the issue of the restitution.
I disagree. I think the state made looked at both of these offenses, which have similar severity levels, similar consequences as a result, and they said, yes, there is a certain matter of proof. It is much more clear and obvious she left the scene. With that is the state, for whatever reason, can find, we still find that no matter what, we're going to give you the benefit of a plea negotiation. We are still asking that you be held responsible, but we're going to, in fact, find you guilty of a different offense with different conduct because you're willing to agree to that, therefore save the victim and all the other necessities, the cost of going to trial. I think there's a little bit of legitimate interest by the state to offer the plea negotiation, saying we're going to save ourselves the trouble of a trial and put that up in front of the court by allowing you to make this argument. But the court then turned around and gave her the opportunity to challenge that restitution by preponderance of the evidence. And I'll note that is the standard that would be applied in a civil case. And looking at that, the important part is the district court judge did take into consideration, as I believe the quote was, the primary contributing factor as proposed by the defense expert was the speed of the defendant's motorcycle. But as the district court noted, that did not exonerate the defendant of any. Oh, I see my time is complete, if I may briefly
finish your comment.
Just, she did have the opportunity to weigh that into consideration, looking whether or not this was part of the direct evidence. She determined that it did not exonerate the defendant or the appellant of her conduct and her driving conduct here. Had a chance to weigh those competing causes, but more importantly is I do think that she looked at the offense as a whole, and even though it was not part of the offense of conviction, it clearly, that offense of conviction looks back into the actual driving conduct of the appellant. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rankin, you may proceed if you wish.
Judge Slater, you noted the timeline of the amended or the contested omnibus, the expert testimony that DC was the primary cause, and the subsequent amendment of the complaint to add a count, removing the causality element from issue. That timeline does suggest that the amendment was in response to that causality, that contested issue at the contested omnibus, and the court's ruling allowing the defense expert to testify at trial.
What was the timing of the amendment and the plea in relationship to each other?
The amendment. The amendment was January 8, 2018, and the plea was February 5, 2018, so less than a month apart.
So here's what troubles me about your argument from a public policy standpoint. It seems to me that if you're right, or if we follow your approach, that it would discourage the state from entering plea negotiations and agreeing to reduced charges. In this case, it seems pretty clear to me from what is undisputed that there would be no difficulty at all proving that your client violated the failed to yield law and that this caused the collision. Sure, there was some contributing cause and there may be some dispute about it, but there's no doubt that the result of the turning into the motorcyclist caused his injuries, and that was the result of her violation. And in this case, that wasn't charged, but it easily could have been charged. And what can you say to the public policy concern that I have? The state sometimes will say, you know what, we're gonna let you plead guilty to something less, but there's no doubt about what happened. Do you agree that your approach would discourage the state from entering plea negotiations and reducing charges?
I don't. I think it would discourage the state from entering plea negotiations without consideration about which offense leads to what resulted or what harm resulting and what losses. Because the state could and has, in other cases, made a plea offer of plead to this count that followed all the accident and the harm, but agree to some restitution. We can contest the amount, but you have to agree to some. That happens fairly often.
In other words, part of the negotiation could be a negotiated sentence, including restitution?
Yes.
But there's no obligation for the district court then to follow the sentence of the agreement of the parties.
Certainly, but if the court has the same concern, the district court has the same concern that you do, that pleading to that count would diminish responsibility in any way, the court would be able to address that with that following that agreement.
Counsel, I have a question.
Yes.
Is there any relevance to the fact that the Minnesota Crime Victims Reparation Board paid reparations to the victim in this case?
Only insofar as the Crime Victim Reparations Board is the outstanding payee.
Well, didn't they have to identify a crime for which they were paying reparations?
I believe the standards are much different than those in a criminal case.
I mean, clearly in typical traffic accidents, you don't, the Crime Reparations Board isn't implicated.
Certainly, but Ms. Hart was charged before the Crime Victims Reparations Board got involved.
Okay.
Allowing restitution for dismissed dismissed charges and charges which were dismissed as a result of a plea negotiation effectively, in this case, doesn't end run around the trial process. The defendant pleaded guilty here specifically with the intent to challenge causality. She'd been challenging causality from the beginning, and allowing the plea negotiation to make it so that she wouldn't have to go to a full trial on those issues, those very issues that bothered her from the beginning of the proceedings, doesn't end run around the trial process and her trial rights. I'd just briefly like to note that if you do consider the preceding events as relevant to the order of restitution, the district court here considered a but-for cause. Without Ms. Harvey's actions, the accident wouldn't have occurred. She did not consider a proximate or a higher-level cause, and Palubicki is very clear that the cause cannot be a but-for cause in a restitution proceeding. I respectfully request that you reverse the restitution order. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. Thank you for your comments today and your briefing, and we will take the matter under advisement. Have a good day. Mm-hmm.